cemetery trust. And I think the reason for this is simply that cemetery trusts are unique, that there is a stated public policy in favor of being able to continue upkeep of graves for an indefinite period, simply because cemeteries may be in existence for an indefinite period, and it's necessary, therefore, to make sure that they do not become an eyesore or a disgrace to the community. And I think that was the public policy behind the enactment of Section 18, which, as Mr. Bowman has stated, we do contend refers to the types of trusts set up under Section 15 of the Cemetery Act. And in particular, I would refer the court to the case cited in our brief, Boyd v. Frost National Bank, which is a Texas Supreme Court case from 1946. And that case is still considered the leading case on the definition of what is charitable in Texas. And the Boyd case follows the common law in the United States and the English common law as well. And basically, the Boyd case states that charitable purposes can include religious, scientific, educational purposes, and they can also include any purposes which would be beneficial to the community. And the Boyd case, I think, was not in any way setting out new law. It was very much following the old common law. And basically, under the common law, charitable purposes have always been exempt from the rule against perpetuities. I don't think that there's ever been any question about that in Texas or any other state.
I mean, even for 1,000 years?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, and, I have no difficulty following your argument on a bequest to the cemetery. But what do you do with the bequest that says, I direct that the entire income or the maximum amount of such income that's permitted under the laws from this gift be expended for keeping and beautifying and for the purchase of flowers for the burial space of my mother, my brother, and myself? Now, where is that charity?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the will obviously directs that it be in compliance with the law, whatever the law is.
Well, what is your view about that part of the will? If that is not a charitable, but is a purely personal bequest.
Well, Your Honor, it's our contention that it is not a purely personal bequest because it does attempt to comply with Section 18, and it has that saving clause in there which states the maximum allowed by law for private purposes. And I think, as Mr. Bowman stated, that without the legislature enacting Section 18, it obviously would be a mixed trust, and it would be in violation of the rule against perpetuity. However, again, under the common law, it has been held, and we have cited several authorities on page 11 of our brief that state that legislatures do have the power to determine what can be considered charitable. And this, again, gets back to the Boyd case, which was, in essence, determining what is charitable. The IRS determines what is charitable. The legislature can, to a certain extent. And by doing so, they, therefore, are exempting these trusts from the rule against perpetuity.
But my narrow question is it within the power of the legislature to define a gift to three persons or for the benefit of three crypts? There are 1,000 out there in the cemetery. By doing that, does the legislature have the power to say that that is a charitable trust?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the legislature does have that power. And again, of course, why would they enact the statute unless it were intended to exempt these trusts from the rule against perpetuity? Otherwise, there would be no meaning to the statute. It could be set up without a statute if it
were. Well, we frequently are called upon to ask ourselves, why did the legislature enact an unconstitutional statute?
Well, Your Honor, we submit the statute is constitutional, and we've submitted various authorities in our brief to show that legislatures in other states have done the exact same thing. In Oklahoma, for example, there is a constitutional rule against perpetuities. And the Oklahoma legislature has enacted a statute very, very similar to Section 18. And we submit that the legislature does have the power to interpret what the rule against perpetuities will and will not apply to. And the issue in this case is not whether they are drafting a whole new idea of what the rule should and should not apply to. I think there's a great deal of basis in the common law for what the legislature has done. But the issue is also conflict, whether in any way Section 18 is in conflict with Article 1, Section 26 of the Texas Constitution. And we maintain that it is not, because the legislature does have the power to decide what shall be charitable and what shall not be charitable. And by deciding this, therefore, it is removed from the purview of the rule against perpetuities. This could be done not only by the Texas legislature, but as I've said before, by the Internal Revenue Service. If the Internal Revenue Service decides that something is charitable, that, for all practical purposes, takes that organization, that trust, that entity out of the rule against perpetuities. And I think the same thing has been done here in Texas. And again, we submit that cemetery trusts are a unique case. I think that the Boyd case very clearly says that private charities, such as a trust set up to benefit one impoverished individual, for example, is definitely not a charity. But at the same time, in this particular case, 25% of the income does go to benefit the cemetery as a whole. I think a very good argument could be made for the uniqueness of cemetery trusts, simply because they will be in existence almost forever. And I think for that reason, the legislature felt the need to encourage people to donate money to trustees of perpetual care cemeteries. And how can you encourage someone to donate money to the trust if they feel that none of the monies will be used for their own individual grave? I think it's certainly an incentive on the part of the legislature to encourage people to donate money for the upkeep of cemeteries by allowing them to have a portion of the income going for their particular grave. Thank you.
Perpetuities are bad. Our Constitution tells us they're bad. We countenance them only if there is a true charitable purpose. There's not a case cited to the court yet that I'm aware of that says the embellished funds set aside in perpetuity to embellish a private grave has a charitable purpose. And it's not what the legislature has power to do so much. It is this charitable? If it's charitable, the bequest is valid. If it's not charitable, if it's selfish, if it's a private trust, it fails. I think it's all that simple. And the attorney for the Republic Bank went to some length to explain that Clinton Fauchet drew this woman's first will that had this clause in it, which in fact he did. In the year 1955, he got a copy of the trust instrument from the cemetery, and he tracked the trust instrument. And then thereafter, the will was drawn by another lawyer, and I would like to read from page 44 of Mr. Fauchet's deposition, just four lines. Question, okay, after her 1955 will, who wrote her subsequent wills? Answer, Zellner Eldridge. Question, all right, and who referred her to Mr. Eldridge? Answer, I don't recall. Either I did or someone in the trust department of the First National Bank in Dallas, after I had consistently refused to draw any will in which any member of my family was a beneficiary. And he's criticized. For now, taking the position that the Now, knowing what the law is, or taking the position that the bequest is no good. If the issue before the court was whether or not the woman wanted the bequest, of course she did. Of course she did. There's no question about that. And of course she thought she was embellishing her grave, and that her grave was going to be something of beauty, and something special, and over and above and beyond that of all others. And of course that was her desire. There's no question about it. But the only point is, on what is relevant before the court today, is whether or not this bequest she makes under this trust that the Republic, that the Hillcrest Mausoleum set up with the Republic National Bank, whether it is a constitutional valid trust. And again, have the trust amendment written that the proceeds and the income from the trust shall be spent 75% for the grave, 25% for the graveyard, and had it further read that we will take 10% of the principal each year for a period of 10 years to be spent so that the principal vanishes with time within a life of being 21 years, it would not be violative of the rule against perpetuities. And the language of the statute allowed the trust to be so provided because it provided that the trust or the proceeds or the income thereof could be spent for such purposes. But a curious thing, in the bottom part of the paragraph, it says at least 75%, not of principal, mind you, but 75% of the proceeds or income can go to the private grave, and 25% of the proceeds or income have to go to the graveyard. So that if principal did, was expended, if they had drawn a constitutional trust, and if principal was expended for the grave, it could all go to the grave, because the only requirement is that 75% of income, not more, of that go to the grave, and that at least 25% go to the general care. There's no requirement that any of the principal go to the general care. And I submit that just simply stated that any way you cut it, that when you one sets out to embellish a private grave, and with the aid of this statute, and where the statute is not tracked, because the trust did not provide for any expenditure of principal, it's not tracked at all. The trust says the money shall be held in perpetuity. The will says the money shall be held in perpetuity. They don't track the statute any way at all. And had they tracked the statute in a way which was available to them, maybe this could constitutionally be done, but as done, it simply can't face the test of the law. It simply is unconstitutional. Without our constitutional provision, without it, absent it, I think the legislature could do anything they wanted to do. But we have the Constitution, over 100 years old, and which was re-ratified some 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was. I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
The court will take a short recess.
It would have appeared ambiguous to all of those attorneys representing all of those clients and looking to find the maximum benefit that they could get for their client. So that I think, as the court said in White, and it continues to be so now, on from that day to the present, it has been generally accepted that Section 12B is intended to be the complete provision as to what is done and is not done in a hernia situation.
Thank you, counsel. Argument from the petitioner, rebuttal.
I described before the initial brief, before the waiver statute, section 440.15, which is the part that deals with the fact that disability benefits are due before the date of operation. I may have misspoke if Mr. Green understood that I said that the other case did not say what he did, but it just wasn't on this issue. I did not know. I think it's important to realize, of course, that it's a creature and creation of the legislature. It's not derived from common law. All the rights, procedures, steps, and so forth are explicitly and expressly set out here in the Act. And those are the procedures and steps which all the parties are required to follow. Now, there was never a formal tender. Now, there's, of course, Durham didn't offer surgery or formal tender where he admitted liability and so forth. There's not a formal tender in this case, but for the sake of argument, that there were a formal tender. At that time, the formal tender surgery and could the association side liability exist. In case the injured employer refused to make an operation, the board shall immediately order a medical examination and take a whole series of other steps. Now, the offer of surgery in the Lowry case, and I don't think there's any law contrary to this, the burden for offering surgery is placed strictly on the insurance carrier. There doesn't have to be an offer forthcoming from the worker. In addition, in TDIA versus Netherlands, which I did cite in the brief, is 48 Southwest 2nd 967, about the Commission of Appeals case. They said it was not the worker's obligation to seek out whatever medical treatment he thought he needed. And I think the rationale is clear. He's not supposed to, or he's not put the burden of making his own diagnosis of what's wrong. Now, the obligation, the burden, as I understand it, is where the employee refuses the operation, the burden of bringing that before the board falls on the insurance carrier. It's not the worker's obligation to go down to the board and say, I refuse the surgery. That's their burden to keep it moving to the board to take whatever steps it's supposed to take. I think, in my opinion, the protection set out in, expressly set out in AB 306, Section 12B, and 8307 Section 4, wherein an insurance carrier can reduce or stop its liability by taking certain steps, are the manner in which legislators told them this is the way to do it. Now I submit their failure to take any of those steps or the appropriate steps at least constitutes a waiver on their part to later on assert anything. But as I said, it's a creature of the legislature. Steps there to take, whether it's to go before the board and say he's refused the surgery or had a hearing to determine whether it's beneficial to be called under 8307 Section 4. It's their burden to get the board to act in this matter. Initially, when I first started speaking, I talked about the policy of liberal construction and so forth. And I think those are, if there is a question in this area, I think that those holdings should be adhered to. I'd like to point out once again that I think the language of Section 12B and Section 10 and Section 12 taken together make it clear that Section 12B, as far as the payment of compensation benefit, is only concerned from the date of a successful operation. Thereafter, certainly, 26 weeks expressed by statute. But that's not in lieu of all other compensation in Section 12, the other statute.
Let me ask you the same question I asked counsel. Suppose the company or the employer of the insurance company does say to a man, we think you need an operation, and we tender you an operation. Does that stop this general injury claim of yours?
Once he says no or yes?
No, just a tender of it.
Well, I think 12B only becomes effective when whether it's the next day or the next week when he goes down and has his operation.
But we don't have any facts. Let's suppose this gentleman, after a couple of weeks, a company or the insurance company goes out and says, we think you've got a hernia, and you should have an operation, and we'll pay for it. And so he lays back on his cot, and he thinks about 5 to 7 weeks. Then what happens?
Well,
Does he get general injury during all that time?
He does if the insurance carrier does not take the express step which is required to take under the Act. And that is, we tender him the operation today. Certainly, I'm sure that the board will give him a reasonable amount of time, a few days to make a decision. But thereafter, when they go to the board for tender surgery, he's refused.
That would result in his being paid for laying there, wouldn't it?
Well, just that whatever the board, whatever days they want to give him, 1 or 2 or 3 days, but certainly not.
Imagine they're going out and they're concerned about him and say, we think you need an operation and we'll pay for it. Now, can he just lay there for...
Oh, I understand. Your Honor, of course, they have to know tender. That means they have to admit liability, admit there's no dispute regarding the injury.
Well, if they do that,
Well, that stage, when they've done that before the board, and he was...
Not before the board, before him.
Well, I think their protection, if he doesn't accept at that time, is to go to the board. I don't think their mere action is sufficient, because it's got to be come back before the board so that they're aware of the action of the company. That would be the odd issue.
This is the board, in other words, that activates the